And we are back with another episode of Crowd Blunders because nobody asked for it.
That's right. My name is Caleb Palmquist.
Yeah, and I'm Alan Dunford, and together we are we're the sages of bad advice. And today we are joined by someone very special. Caleb, do you want to introduce him?
Yeah, today we have an old friend of mine, Russell Nolte, who you might know from books like Cthulhu is Hard to Spell, Katrina Hates Dead Stuff, and Ichabod Jones, and a lot of other projects, as well as a lot of great advice that Russell has dispensed over the years on the internet about comics and writing and crowdfunding. So, welcome, Russell.
Thanks so much. I feel like I should mention modern mythology also. Maybe you have a vested interest in that book, but yes, I was one of the creators on that with my good friend Nick Torres.
Yeah, that's right. I did a book a few years ago called Modern Mythology, which is an anthology book that Russell did a story w that was drawn by Nick Torres. And
We've talked about that one a lot.
well, we've talked about it, but also a fun fact is a little shameless self-promotion. Nick is drawing a book of mine called Space Monkey Nights Go, which is coming to Kickstarter next month.
That's amazing. Nick is the best. I'll bet it is very action filled and hilarious because those are the two things that like define a Nick Torres book for me.
Right, absolutely. And Russell's worked with Nick a lot. He's done a lot of projects with Nick Torres, who's just we can't say enough good things about Nick Torres. Okay, today's episode it was inspired by a Substack post that Russell put out recently. And I believe the title of the post was, "Is it even possible to be a writer and happy at the same time?" And I read this and I thought this is perfect for this podcast because what's more pressing? What's like a bigger thing in creative life than sort of managing happiness?
Yeah, that was something that we actually talked about previously. Was I guess just trying to manage your—I don't even say work. It's like work-life balance, but also trying to throw in your extracurricular activity of being a writer as well. And how do you actually even manage your time and stress with that? So this is like a fantastic segue.
Right. So the way we start the podcast every time is by talking about our blunders. So, Russell, do you want to tell us what mistakes you made in balancing happiness and creativity?
Sure. All right. So there's a big, I think there's three. I can remember two off the top of my head. The first is that I linked success to happiness, which is great when you were having a lot of success. But that success doesn't last forever. And when that ride down is really hellish. Like it's really not a great ride down if you've linked your success with external metrics. So definitely being externally motivated more than internally motivated is one. The other one that I know for sure is believing that it would get easier. I thought at some point, 30 books in, 50 books in, 20 books in, like it would get easier, and it only compounds and gets harder over time. Sorry, I don't want to be a bummer, but like you have to get very comfortable with the idea that, like, even 10 years on, I sit at conventions I've done every year since I started, and people are like, "Who are you?" And I'm like, "Really? Still? Like, really? Like,
I
not
have
like,
50 books.
it's like I've been in the same spot for like 5 years. Like, really?"
You talked to me last year. Do you not remember?
That happens sometimes also, be
Oh,
and
no.
because and a lot of but a lot of times most people are like run past you when they've already made a decision about you. So like I think the third one would be something around like making like taking rejection too hard, or just like actually thinking that like I do a lot of neutral thinking. There's a post on that Substack called Everything's Beige Now, or I'm Very Beige Recently, which is talking about like clipping off the ends of both happiness and sadness and just living a little bit more to the middle of the spectrum of emotions. And I definitely feel like I've run hot in one way when I was angry, but also I ran hot when I was happy. And then all of that led to big crashes where I was like super sad and depressed. And yes, medications helped. But what also helped is just saying, like, what if I just like clip off the end of the sadness when it leads into like horrible, horrible, bad thoughts? And in doing so, I was like, I also clipped off the very high, like elatedness that I used to have. And then also like the top of anger. So just like bringing it all kind of to the middle more is the third one.
Sure. that makes a lot of sense. I can definitely relate to linking happiness to success. And I mean, I've talked about this a lot, but when, you know, just a few years ago, I was thinking like, man, if I could make $10,000 on a Kickstarter, that would be it. You know,
yeah, I had the exact same thought, man. And then it just wasn't, that high is not enough anymore, Caleb, is
oh yeah, for sure. And you know, it's like, and then and each benchmark that you get to, you know, you think like, oh, when I get there, I'll be happy. And that's such a dangerous road to go down, because those things aren't going to lead to happiness. I think that something that I found that helps is trying to find joy in like the small moments and the moments of creation, rather than, like you said, rather than in, am I successful? Am I making money? Are people,
have you ever
nice
read Ingrid? I think her name's Ingrid Felsley's book, Joyful.
No.
It actually talks about like how to find a joy in things. And I find like being joyful is a completely different experience from being happy. And like, I shun ways that like I can be happy, but I do search for all sorts of ways to like chase the joy of like the moment and of existing in life.
That's awesome. I'll have to check that out. I definitely, you know, it's like, I think if you, I mean, I don't know what's in this book, but if you can chase like you said, the moments of joy and little things, and I have lots of ways to just level myself out throughout the day. I mean, I'll go on a run if I'm feeling down, because that is just like an easy endorphin rush for me, is to go on a run or, you know, sit down and write something or whatever it is, or like sit down and play a video game. But I have definitely the roller coaster, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this, like, cause we run Kickstarters all the time. Right. And the Kickstarter is like such an example of like intense emotions all packed into a small space in a small time. You get really excited about the Kickstarter coming, and then as it continues to fund, it like is really exciting. Or if it's not doing well, that can be really depressing. Even if you have a Kickstarter that's doing really well, you like get really excited, like, wow, it's going, and you're checking every day. And then when it's over, it's like, it's just over. There's like this like void left over. If you're not careful, you're like investing so much of yourself into that process and those emotions, that it can end up being very draining, even if you are having success.
I think of it more like fashion designers. So there was a fashion designer on Masterclass that talked about how they deal with in seasons where they have ups and they downs, and they try and peak at the time of like London Fashion Week or Paris Fashion Week or New York Fashion Week, like to debut their line. But then there's like a recovery time also that they build in. And I think that you definitely need most people do not factor in that recovery time. They just set on to the next thing. But it's really important that it looks like a cresting wave that goes up and down. And then there's a valley where you can create and exist without like monetary compensation being the forefront of your life for a while before you start building again. And my business partner and I are dealing with it, are launching this new author ecosystem. And one of them is a tundra, and a tundra is all about like these cresting waves of rolling fields of big ups and then downs, and the downs being recovery time and then creation time before you start building back up to another launch and building that audience again.
Right. Right. For sure. And I mean, I think like our audience need the recovery time too, like honestly, from like a business perspective, We can't be like, you know, shoving sales messages in front of them 24/7. Have you guys ever listened to the It's Always Sunny podcast?
Yes, I have.
So in one of the more recent episodes, they actually talked about how they like sold out these venues like over in England when they were over like watching the Wrexham games. And Rob McElhenney was talking about how, you know, he was on this tour and he was like selling sold out stadiums for his podcast of all things. And people were cheering his name and like shouting old clips from It's Always Sunny. And then he went home and like had to like feed the dog and like mow the lawn and like hang out with his kids. And he was like, he was very conscious of like how that could feel less interesting, less exciting, and like disappointing compared to a stadium of 50,000 people shouting his name. And I think that's a pretty extreme example. But I can definitely relate to it in terms of like, oh, like when I'm running Kickstarter and it's like breaking records and I'm feeling good about myself and people are saying nice things to me. And then like the next week, I'm just like living my life, like hanging out with my fiance and like walking the dog, you know?
For sure. Yeah. It's there's a podcast called The Happiness Lab, which I recommend often, which is all about like scientific reasons and ways to be happier in your life and to bring more joy into your life. And I highly recommend that one. Also,
The Happiness Lab. I'll definitely check it out.
Yes. I'm kind of obsessed with, in case you haven't noticed, I'm kind of obsessed with like how to, it's not even about how to be happy. It's about how to. So a lot of my life has been, I would imagine being a car in reverse, like, and you have to spend all of your day just trying to get back to neutral, and as opposed to being neutral and then being able to maybe be positive. So most of my life has been about like, oh, I'm driving back. I wake up and I'm driving backwards into depression, and I have to like spend all of my energy just to get back to neutral. And then like maybe, and I can say like meds and better mindsets and all of this stuff has like waking up in neutral is literally life changing for me. So I've been obsessed with this idea of happiness, not because I necessarily want to be happy, but just because like I needed to stop being that big sad and having those endorphin highs and lows that do crest. And one thing I do think that finding the joy in those little moments is very helpful to like not having those depressive moments of come down after a campaign ends. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. The high highs and the low lows. Yeah. I mean, I totally get that. So I guess with all that being said, you know, with the posts in mind and everything like that, looking at some of your campaigns, especially early on, because I feel like those are the ones that we find the most fault in. What's some of the things that stuck out to you from a learning experience that you've learned with your campaigns?
Okay, so if you are thinking, so the biggest thing that I have seen recently is people having success on Kickstarter and then expanding their line to 5 or 6 or 10 books, but not actually expanding their audience at all. So like now they're making roughly the same amount of money but across 10 projects, and they're destroying their profit margins because now they can't fund that one book at $10,000. They have to now fund 6 books at $1,000, and it like destroys them because like it's 6 times more work to run 6 campaigns.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So since that's been on my mind, a couple of things to consider. Not every campaign can or should be designed to be your big hitter. So we have Cthulhu is Hard to Spell, and Cthulhu is Hard to Spell was like our big hitter for a long time. Like it raised $30,000 to $40,000. It collected a lot of money every time it launched.
That's awesome, man.
But like then I would launch a book that I drew called How Not to Invade Earth, and it raised $3,000. Right. And like that campaign was only 5 days long. And I promise you, if you look at those two side by side, you'd be like, oh, yes, I totally understand why this book raised $3,000 and you only had it live for 5 days and you were actively trying to not have people see it because you didn't want it to be their first introduction to like your comic brand. Or I'll do a book series and I'll do like 4 books and I'll raise $15,000. Then I'll do it 1 book and might raise $5,000 and only do 2 weeks. So you can vary up your time frames because like most people just want to do a bunch of 30-day campaigns and that's exhausting. I think you should also do like a 17-day campaign is pretty ideal for.
Yeah, I've definitely started going down because I used to run the full month, but I've been brave enough to finally go down to like 22.
Yeah, I think that unless you are, I have seen no discernible difference in backer excitement between 17 and really like maybe 20, like between right. 17 and 20 days and 30 to 40 days, unless you plan to do a ton of press. There is no reason to burn out your audience unless and yourself with a 3 or 4 or 5 week campaign, unless you plan to book podcasts constantly and reach out to people to do backer swaps constantly. There are books that I am willing to do that for, like Ichabod Jones, we did like 20,000 a book. And then Cthulhu, we did like 30 or 40,000 a book. So like I knew those were our big hitters. And so I invested more time, energy, and effort in backer swaps and all of that stuff. When we do novels and the audience isn't there, like as the audience isn't as inviting to novels as they are to comics, like I don't do that. And varying up those lengths really helps. Varying up your expectations is even better because most people will say, oh, I raised $10,000. That means every book I ever release will make $10,000. And that is just not true.
If like, only.
it's a combination. Cthulhu is hard to spell, works so well because it's about a popular brand on Kickstarter with a very, very specific take that I had not seen done in comics, which is focusing on the monsters and gods themselves. So I stacked a whole bunch of cool stuff together to make this my big hitting book and put it in front of people so that they could make a decision very quickly. I have books like Anna in the Dark Place or How Not to Invade Earth or This Is Not a Book, which just launched. And raised like $5,000. But like, these are not books that like are going to get a lot of press because This Is Not a Book like has no newsworthy angle that is easily hookable. I wouldn't even hire a press person for that book because like people would be confused. There's not a good match of saying, this is not a book. I know what that is, click. And I'm not saying you should have that for every book because I certainly don't, but focus your attention on the books that have the biggest hitter impact where someone can do a backer swap because I do a lot of backer swaps. And the thing that I find all of the time is most books, like I can't just click on and know what they're about. I can't look at a cover and be like, yep, my audience will like that. And I can tell you that when you're doing advertising, when you're doing marketing, when you're doing outreach, having that very easy book cover is like a key to getting people to click. 100 people could put you in their newsletters. But if you don't have somebody, something that is easily clickable and shareable that people can say, I want that, they're not even going to read the description to click. And so you're going to be wasting your time, which is why I only do that for the big hitting projects. And people are like, I will do 100 backer swaps on maybe 50 on like a Cthulhu based project. Then also it has the network effect of 70 creators working together. And also, those are all people working in a very specific niche of like horror comics or monster comics or something along those lines. There's a high correlation to people who like that book. But there's all of this stuff that you're like, well, do you have that? No. Like your mom's probably going to back it the first day. Like your friends are probably going to back it early. Your fans on your thing are going to back it because they know you and they trust you. But are you going to get to that level where like you can get organic reach? And if the answer is no, then like do a smaller campaign. Maybe don't put all of your eggs in that basket. Like, don't invest $10,000 into your weird book that like has a very small audience. Instead, invest a bunch of money into your big book. And then once that has profit, then you can funnel it into your smaller book and maybe like make the weird thing that you've always wanted to make, even though it's not going to have a profit. But you can't go into every book that launches saying, well, this is going to be a big hitter, because they all should not be your big hitters, because it's just going to exhaust you. And if you're going to do that, you should not do more than like 2 or 3 campaigns a year, because you will leave it, just like Caleb was talking about, so exhausted. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. I have about 1 million more.
So I wanted to sort of bring it back a little bit to the happiness thing and talk about, you know, when you're launching a campaign, just like sort of your mood and like what's going on with you, like sort of how does that impact your campaigns? Because for me, there have definitely been campaigns where I had intended to do a harder press and do more swaps and do more podcasts and press and everything else. And for whatever reason, I was like down that month or that during that period. And I just like didn't have it in me. And sometimes I've noticed that like where it's like, I almost certainly would have made more money or gotten more backers if I had put myself more into it. And I just wasn't feeling it. Do you find that your mood going into a campaign can really affect how it does?
I have no mood going into a campaign anymore. Like I have data. I have data and I have systems, so I don't need moods. Like I know what my email sequence is going to be every day of a campaign. And it's already mostly scheduled out before a campaign even launches. So like it can just, if I die, some of my campaigns, I could literally die and it would still like send emails out until the campaign was over, because I know historically I have had depressive episodes. And so I would build the emails and the wording and everything like while I wasn't like depressive. And that was really helpful. I also have like a system of every second week of a campaign, I'm going to do a sideways sales letter, which is taking bits of the campaign in chunks and just sharing that into my newsletter and onto social media. Well, previously onto social media. So I will literally just be like, what is the, like my section, what is the world about? What are the characters about? And just like, well, that's a week right there. And then like, I always know that 2 days out of the week, I'm going to have like bonus books, because on Sunday, I'm going to unlock new perks that like everyone does this. And on Saturday, I'm going to say all of these perks close. And so I'm really like, okay, now there's 5 days and Sunday is a rest day. So every week works the same. And I have found for myself that if I have that routine of like every first week is an email goes out on the first day saying it's live. The second day, there's an email usually about like a bonus perk. And then the third day is usually something like, here's the bonus. So like a lot of times I'll do like a pin. And so I'll be like, look at the pin. Isn't this cool? Or the print or something. And I'll focus on that. Then like, if there's only one day to get bonus perks and they want the week one perks, and then like week one perks are closing. And like, that's most 5 days. Week two is like building out that, the sideways sales letter. Week three, if I have a week three, then it's you. I mean, by week three, now it's like, now we're closing, just so you know, like, or if I'm doing a longer one, then maybe I'll like slow down or I'll do some more stretch goals or something. But like, I have all of this planned out before the campaign ends, before the campaign even starts. As I'm building it, I'm like copying stuff over and copying blurbs over. And I told somebody wanted to hire me to do their marketing for the campaign. And I was like, well, that's stupid, because like, you could just buy my course or my book, because all I'm going to do is take your campaign and like literally break it up for you, like in emails. Like you can just literally copy my emails. And then like, that's the template that I'm going to use for yours. And so I will do this. It will cost you a small fortune, but like I do it the same every single time, with little variations. Sometimes I send a different post, like one. Sometimes instead of doing like the pin post, I'll be like, wow, we hit $10,000 already. Sometimes a book will vastly exceed what I think it's going to make. And I'll be like, I'm unlocking more perks because we've already burned through all of the week one goals that I set. So all of those things are on my mind. beforehand. And then secondarily, I am okay without maximizing the money that I make. Sure. That is a rule that I had to make that for my own mental health, saying if a book does at least this amount, like it was worth spending this month. And maybe that amount is $500. Maybe that amount is $5,000. But it's really important for me to disconnect from that. And I think the way that I disconnect is my books are done roughly a year in advance from when I finish them. Like, so I can impassionately, I can make that dispassionate severance between the two things, because it's just been so long. And it's often helpful, because then I'm like, okay, like, what excited me about this book? And this is the most important part of Kickstarter, is like building that excitement in your fans for this book. And so when I am away from, when I'm in the book, I'm like, well, I don't know. I love Angela. I love this. And getting distance and having to actually say, okay, Russell, like, fall in love with this book again, as if we were a reader, is a lot easier when you are like further away from it, and you don't have the ability to say, I loved making this page and that page and this other page. After a year, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to do a campaign for this book. I just like, and so literally forcing yourself to fall back in love is very helpful. I don't know if any of that made sense, but my happiness comes from having analytical data about every campaign I've made and knowing roughly what my numbers are going to be on every day of a campaign, or at least every week of a campaign, and being able to predict out what someone makes. Like, people hate data as creators, but data makes everything a math problem, which sounds terrible, but it is actually wonderful, because when you have math, you can say, well, I had a mailing list of 10,000 people and I made $10,000 with this many clicks and this many sales, and this was my average pledge rate. So if I just put all of those numbers in, like, I should be able to do 5% more, 5% less, 10% less, whatever that is. You kind of start getting a feel for it. But you start saying, I was having this conversation about the article that I posted today was like, if you know that it takes 10 million people seeing your work before you can have a six-figure business, that sounds daunting, but it is way less daunting than saying, I want a successful business and have no idea what to do. If I can bring this down to a math problem and say, Caleb, talk to 10 million people, you'll be like, that's so many people. I'm like, oh, well, if you do that, I can almost guarantee you a successful career. And if you don't want to do that, you should give up now, because that's what's going to take. Like, at least there is data in front of you that is not this ethereal, ephemeral thing, which I think makes people very unhappy, because they are doing actions that someone has said returned money for them, and they're not seeing it. And they're saying, I don't understand why I am broken. Because really, I think when it comes back down to happiness, like, when we are saying this campaign is not funding or not doing the same thing, like, the real fear most of us feel is like, I am broken. Something is wrong with me. Like, I have failed everyone. Right. And like, being able to say, let me look at the data and see, oh, well, this email was only opened by half of the people, or like, wow, I missed this big mailing list thing, or like, huh, well, I'm tracking down, I need to get a bunch more eyeballs. Like, I predicted that I needed 10,000 people to see this campaign, but I really need 20,000. So, well, if I wanted to succeed, I need to reach out to at least 500 campaigns to get 100 people to say, like, if you have data on all of those numbers, like, suddenly this is not an ethereal problem. Right. It's not like an esoteric, how do I become a successful creator? It's saying, oh, I miscalculated badly, or wow, this went way better than I did. How do I stack all of this stuff that works into like a functional, like, creative business person? Because what they don't tell you is most business owners are really just like three squirrels in a trench coat.
Right. So, I mean, I definitely agree about data. I think, you know, I've run I want to say like 18 campaigns now, and I can look at them, and there's some real clear patterns, and that honestly brings me a definite sense of like it reduces the anxiety a lot, because I can say, if I launch this type of book and I have this big of a reach and this many and this percentage of open rate on my emails, and then I can, like, you know, I'm no longer living in anxiety. If I'm like, okay, I have a $5,000 goal and I know what type of project it is, I can make like a reasonable guess about how much I'm going to be able to do with the reach that I have. And I'm not just like, oh, like early on, it'd be like, oh, you set a $2,000 goal and you're like just sort of praying, you know?
Yeah. Well, I will say, I just want to say one thing, because I remember you before Modern Mythology and before Unicorn Vampire Hunter. And before all of these books that you've used to like build up this career, I remember when you were saying like, how can I, like, I don't understand why I'm not making it. And I distinctly remember being like, he just doesn't know the data. Like he just hasn't put it together. He just hasn't, like, he's got all of the pieces, but he didn't put the jigsaw puzzle, like, isn't putting together. And when I saw that Modern Mythology campaign, I was like, oh, like, he's got it. If he runs another campaign in fantasy that is like this campaign, which a lot of people don't do, they will have a huge success and then they'll do something totally different. And you're like, why can't I have that success? I'm like, just do the thing you love, do the thing your audience loved, and then do your other stuff on the side. But I remember when you did the Unicorn Hunter and I saw it, I was like, oh, like, this is going to go bananas, because like, it is the same. It was aesthetically similar. It was tonally similar. Like, it looked like the best stories in the Modern Mythology book. And if someone liked that Modern Mythology, like, they were probably going to like the Unicorn. Like, there was this, it was your biggest book at the time. So you made a book and then said, remember that book you liked? Well, here's another book like that. And shockingly, people bought it. And
I made that decision because I was watching you, because I saw that you did, I think it might've been Monsters and Other Scary Stuff before Cthulhu. And then you launched Pixie Dust right after that, right?
Yeah.
And it was huge.
It like made it, that singular decision of doing Monsters and Other Scary Stuff first and then Pixie Dust second made my career. Like, if I was the other way, I don't think I would have had a career.
Right. So, but yeah, I mean, I think that's great. Like, so my takeaways from this are data helps, and also just like, be prepared. Like, if you go into a campaign and you don't have everything ready and you're relying on yourself to make all the right decisions day to day about promoting your book, if you're depressed or sad or whatever, you're going to screw it up. But if you're prepared, it doesn't matter. Everything's going to run, the ship's going to run. And I think so many of these things come from, you know, like you said, there were people like you putting out good information on the internet, but some of it just takes like doing it and learning and figuring it out. Because you can hear all the best advice in the world and not really understand it until you've done it.
Yeah. And with data, it's the same thing. Like, it's like, well, you just look at data numbers, but you're like, no, that means something. There is one other, when you see what it means, then like suddenly the connection starts to be, you start to love data when you can see it like actually influence things and it has like logical paths. Cause I hated data in school, but like, I love it now.
Right.
There is one thing though, takeaway that you can implement now, which is to understand and realize that you are not what you make. You are not the money you make. You are not the books you make. The books you make are a part of you, but they do not contribute at all to the intrinsic worth that you have as a human being. And you and our society very clearly wants us to equate money with value as a human life, and including Substack. Like, Substack judges you and gives you those little check marks you used to get on Twitter by taking how many people are paying for your information and using that as basically the only metric that matters to value you. You get 100 people, you get a little check. You get 1,000, they fill that in. But it's not 1,000 people following you. It's 1,000 people actually paying money. And that is seemingly the only metric they care about. And as a, and is a perfect example of where we as a society are, which is to say you had a $10,000 campaign. That means you must be twice as good as someone who had a $5,000 campaign. Right. But that is not true. And before you do a Kickstarter, or before you do your next Kickstarter, the absolute best advice that I can give you is to find a way to separate yourself and separate your self-worth from the things you make and the money you make. It is very, very, very hard, but it is the work that will Sorry, I was thinking about a person that both Caleb and I worked with who left tragically too soon, and like it will literally save your life. It can literally save your life to figure out how to separate your self-worth from the books you make. That does not mean you shouldn't do your best and make the best book and like sell the most money and like make $100,000. I hope all of you do that. But regardless of whether you make $5 or you make $5 million on Kickstarter this year, it has no bearing on your intrinsic value or your ability or value to exist as a human being, because that is baked in right down at your core. No matter what you do, you deserve to put your work out and then live a creative life just for literally being born.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Whew. Okay. So we have gone way over our normal recording time, which is great. It just means we had a good conversation. Before we go though, I do know that Russell, you have a campaign coming up, that we're going to leave a link in the show notes to the Kickstarter campaign, but can you tell us about your campaign that's going to be live?
Sure. So a campaign is going to be live on the 16th, Tuesday at 2 o'clock from Unlikely Hero Studios is my first all ages book. It's called Lucifer Licorice. It is not a Stone Cold Bummer. I promise. Like, this is a fun, happy Adventure Time meets regular show meets Summer Camp Island. Silly romp about a spoiled brat prince who's turned into a licorice monster and has to learn how to stop being so bitter so he can become go back to his old body. It features his best friend is a tea towel ghost. There are bubblegum birds that try and peck him. There are demons. There's a trip to Hecken. Like, there is everything that you would want to see from a good episode of Adventure Time. It is very, 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 very weird. I don't know if it's helped me draw this giraffe weird, but like, it's very weird. And I love it. I love it so much. Also, I have a Substack. It's authorstack.substack.com, which is where Caleb found that post, if you're interested in following me there. And we've got a lot of cool stuff coming up through my company, Writer MBA.
Okay, cool. And we will put the link to the Kickstarter and the link to the Substack in the show notes. So I would definitely recommend checking out the Substack because it's got a lot of good advice and musings on creativity and writing and Kickstarter and business. Definitely check that out. And the Lucifer Licorice is drawn by Angela Odling, who is someone that Russell and I have been friends with for a long, long time. And she's very, very talented. Very excited about that. So thank you so much for coming on and for sharing your blunders and your advice with us. This was a really great conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And sorry, Angela, you are amazing. I should have mentioned you when I talked about the comic.
All right. Well, until then, we'll be back next week. Alan and I will with more blunders. But until then, everyone have a good week. And thanks for listening. Bye.
All right. Bye, guys.